The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
There are worse things Trump could do than to send a tweet or two, kiss all decency goodbye, rudely trash the FBI, pay off porn stars when they're through. But there's still worse things he could do. He could screw with Dreamer kids when his ratings hit the skids. Change his mind on immigrants, make them think they stand a chance, then say screw 'em if they're not white, to please nut jobs on the right. I could watch the news and scream, wait around for Mueller's team, drink martinis every day, and hope and wish and pray our impeachment dream comes true. Still for now, the GOP, out of sheer insanity, lets Trump steal and lets him lie. But we can tell those schmucks goodbye and get rid of Trump's whole crew. 'Cause to turn the midterms blue, that's the best thing we could do.
Ah, a little ditty from our pal Lauren Mayer to get us started on this Wednesday. There are worse things Trump could do. Not many, you know. His latest is, it just shows the depravity of the man's mind. Yeah, his call for a military parade down Pennsylvania Avenue, showing off the strength and might of the U.S. military. Unbelievable. So I'm Nicole Sandler. Welcome to the show. It is a Wednesday here at NicoleSandler.com and, of course, on the Progressive Voices Network. And I told you last week we have lost the services of the Talk Media News Service. So I'm sort of reconfiguring the show a little bit, trying to figure out what to do to fill the 15 minutes or so that they used to fill for us each week. So today we have a live and extended version of What's News, to try to cover most of what's going on in the world, and to open up the phone lines. So you know how it works here when you call in, 954-889-6410, or you can always Skype in to Nicole Sandler. I work without a producer, so that's why we are sometimes technically challenged here on the show. And sometimes things are a little sloppier than they might otherwise be. But if you call in, what happens is I punch you in, and then you just have to listen. Feel free to call in anytime. You may be on hold for a little bit while I finish up whatever I'm doing, but the first half hour of the show, it's open phone lines for you. Anything you want to weigh in on, feel free. But for now, let's start with a live and in-depth version of What's News.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, today we start with breaking news, and I'm reading right from the Politico Playbook Power Briefing, as it's the most recent update I could find on this. What they write is that congressional leaders have clinched a two-year deal to lift strict budget caps on defense and domestic spending. This according to a Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The deal is expected to increase defense and domestic spending by roughly $300 billion over 2 years, according to administration and congressional sources. The Republicans went into a meeting at 12:30 to discuss the specifics. Let's see, it sets the stage for Congress to write a full-year funding bill by March 23rd. The debt ceiling is expected to be lifted as part of that deal. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, said that CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, will also get 4 more years of funding in addition to the 6-year extension already approved during the last budget fight. So that's good. It also includes disaster relief and community health center funding. So the Democrats are getting a couple of things. Now, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi made a statement that she could not support this big budget agreement coming down the pike unless she gets, quote, a commitment from Speaker Ryan comparable to the commitment from Leader McConnell to vote on immigration legislation. McConnell has committed to putting an immigration bill on the floor or allowing an open process that could produce an immigration bill. By the way, Pelosi has been speaking on the House floor now for over 4 hours in what some reporters have dubbed a hashtag DACA buster. Now, it's not technically a filibuster because it's the Senate that filibusters. But, someone in the chat room, Lisi D, said she just hit hour 5. I turned it on a little while ago. Here's a little bit of what Nancy Pelosi is doing.
My plans after graduating from Alverno
She's
College
reading statements from Dreamers.
Making health care accessible to all.
So this is
and
one of those.
Giving back to the community that I love so much. There are, geez, get the sniffles. I think it's this rug in this room. They're dreamers that have become lawyers, doctors, police officers, and small business owners thanks to DACA, and their career choices benefit the country as a whole. We are a group of hardworking individuals who just want the opportunity for a better life. My parents chose to smuggle me across the border was irresponsible.
So just a little taste of what's going on in the House. Nancy Pelosi just hit hour 5 reading statements of dreamers. Now, Robert Hill in New York City in the chat room just said a deal. Did they screw the dreamers, the seniors, or everyone? Well, probably everyone. Dreamers are not included in this. That's why she is saying that she wants Paul Ryan to commit to having a vote on DACA. Much as Mitch McConnell promised, as you know, Mitch McConnell can promise as much as he wants until it actually happens. I don't necessarily believe it's going to happen. But DACA and the Dreamers have been taken out of this deal. So it's going to be a standalone thing, no matter how they address it, if they address it, whatever way they address it. Let's see. So Paul Ryan said earlier this week he will put immigration legislation on the floor, quote, that the president supports. Good luck figuring that out, right? Who knows what the hell that guy supports? We'll get to that in a moment. Here's another dose of reality. Pelosi's top aides have been part of the budget negotiations, which stretched into last night and continued this morning. So she is a party to this deal. Then again, I do give her credit for standing up and at least, you know, reading these statements on behalf of the Dreamers. At least she's doing something. Now, there's a chance that the House doesn't get its hands on this funding bill until Friday. The government runs out of money Thursday night at midnight, so a short-term spending bill might be needed to avoid a shutdown. The Washington Post's Amber Phillips explains what's been going on here.
Congress's job is to fund the United States government. They control the purse strings. But Congress has been unable to do its basic job for a couple years now. There's a variety of disagreements. But for the past 4 months, Congress has been in a perpetual shutdown watch over a couple basic issues. Immigration, whether to fund long-standing programs like the Children's Health Insurance Program, The thing that makes funding a government so difficult for Congress is you basically have to do it with bipartisan votes. So that means whatever party's in power needs the other party to cooperate. That also means that that other party gets to put its foot down and say, no, I'm not going to give you votes unless you do X, Y, and Z. And so that's where we found ourselves in for the past couple months. Democrats could get a chance to extract some big policy victories, like on immigration and government spending, but they also might be seen as obstructionists if Republicans can cast them as the ones that shut down the government and wouldn't compromise over a spending bill. That dynamic over various issues has been playing out more or less for the past 4 months. Congress's fallback is to pass a short-term spending bill, and experts say that's probably what will happen if Congress can't come to agreement on these big issues. Worst case scenario, they keep kicking the can down the road all the way until October, which is when it's time to pass a new budget anyway. But there's a complicating factor here, and that's President Trump. He has been really, really hardline on getting money for his wall. Not a fence, not more border security, a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border.
You need a real wall. That'll work 99.9%.
So, Congress passes the budget. The president is the one who signs it into law. Never say never with President Trump. It's quite possible he vetoes even a short-term spending bill to try to get Congress to do something on his wall.
Ay, 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 the fucking wall. Meanwhile, Trump seems unaware that Congress is separating immigration from the funding deal, saying Tuesday that he'd shut the government down if the parties can't agree on immigration restrictions.
Frankly, I'll go a step further. If we don't change the legislation, if we don't get rid of these loopholes where killers are allowed to come into our country and continue to kill gang members, and we're just talking about MS-13. There are many gang members that we don't even mention. If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown.
Unreal.
And it's worth it for our country. I'd love to see a shutdown.
Of course
you would.
If we
don't get this stuff taken care of. So we have to strengthen our borders, not by a little bit, but by a lot. We are so far behind the time. And by the way, the world is laughing at us because they can't
believe at you.
These policies. They don't have it. I could name 15 of them right now. Yeah. No other country in the world.
Someone should have challenged him on that.
And we're going to get it stopped. And if we have to shut it down because the Democrats don't want safety, and unrelated but still related, they don't want to take care of our military, then shut it down. We'll go with another shutdown.
Okay. Yeah, and they'd call it the Schumer shutdown. Meanwhile, it was the Trump shutdown. It's not going to shut down, as we just told you. They've come to some kind of a deal. But with Trump, who's such a loose cannon, there's no way to know what way it's going to go. Anyway, an hour or so later in the White House press briefing, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said the president wasn't advocating for a shutdown. You just heard his words. Here she is telling you that the sky is green.
A few weeks ago, he said that a shutdown would be devastating to the military. Does he now feel that a shutdown would be worth it, even if members of the U.S. military were negatively impacted?
Look, the only people that have caused a shutdown are the Democrats who have repeatedly held the government hostage over their own politics. Democrats actually shut the government down. Let's not forget that just a couple weeks ago. The president isn't looking for this, but if the Democrat Party is going to continue to threaten a shutdown because they won't include responsible immigration reforms, including fixing MS-13 loopholes and other issues, then the president welcomes that fight. It's a fight we won last time, and it's one we're very confident that we would win again. But let me repeat, our goal is to get a two-year budget deal and to also get a deal on immigration, which we have laid out. The president has generously laid out a plan that addresses both Republicans and Democrats' concerns, and we're hopeful we'll come to an agreement on both of those fronts.
But isn't the president encouraging a shutdown here?
Yes.
The president's encouraging people to do their jobs. The president's encouraging them to get a deal on the budget as he's laid out, a two-year, a long-term budget deal that actually helps our military instead of doing these short-term deals. That's what he's advocated for all along. And the president is encouraging them to do their jobs and come to an agreement on immigration, particularly the four places that he's outlined that have to happen in any piece of legislation.
Sarah. Enough of that. That's Sarah Sanders lying once again. Now, one reason Trump might be so insistent on this point about the shutdown, about his immigration plans, about shutting down legal immigration, is because he wants to keep America as white as possible for as long as possible. Chris Hayes explained this last night.
Take a look at this headline today from the Washington Post. The Trump immigration plan could keep white in the U.S. majority for up to 5 more years. The census currently projects white people will no longer be the majority by 2044. The Post finds that under Trump's plan, whites could remain as a majority until 2049, buying a precious 5 years. That is what Donald Trump's plan would do, keep the nation as white as possible for as long as possible. And the plan is so important to this president that he is willing to shut down the government if he doesn't get it.
Isn't that frightening? It is just so frightening. He is the white nationalist in chief. With a March 5th Trump-imposed deadline looming on DACA, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly was asked if the president would consider an extension if no deal was reached in time. Kelly said he'd advise against it.
Should your boss's immigration plan not get 60 votes in here, which seems very likely, right, as a fallback, can you live with 1 year extension of DACA, 1 year?
I can't imagine men and women of goodwill who beg this president to solve the problem of DACA. And as generous as that four pillars has been, I can't imagine they would vote against it. I mean, this is more than they could have imagined. And I would offer that if before the champions of DACA were members on one side of the aisle, I would say right now the champion of all people that are DACA is Donald Trump. But you would never
get it.
I would certainly advise against it.
Of course you would. You bigot.
I would advise against it. I'm not the president. Anytime you give this institution time, they'll take it.
Anytime you give this institution time, they'll take it. I don't know what that means. Kelly went on to tout the president's four pillars plan for DACA and demean those who didn't sign up for the program.
You probably know this, that we were asked for the president's perspective on taking care of the DACA issue, and he sent over what has termed his four pillars. I think the first part of that, which was stunning and no one expected it, was there are 690,000 official DACA registrants, and the president sent over what amounts to be 2.5 times that number, to 1.8 million. The difference between 690 and 1.8 million were the people that some would say were too afraid to sign up, others would say were too lazy to get off their asses, but they didn't sign up. So the president shockingly said, okay, 1.8 million, and then probably the biggest shock was in a path to citizenship.
What a creep this man is. CNN reported that House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer confronted Kelly about those comments in a closed-door meeting among lawmakers in Kevin McCarthy's office. Following the meeting, Kelly reiterated his comments to reporters, saying some of these eligible immigrants, quote, just should have probably gotten off the couch and signed up. Unbelievable. Our pal, Sarah Sanders, was asked if that was the position of the White House.
Kelly said today that some Dreamers were, quote, too lazy to get off their asses to register for DACA protections. Is that the position of this White House, that Dreamers are lazy? Who thinks this?
The position of the White House is that we want to fix a problem that was created by the previous administration. We have a system that is not lawful. We have a system that has a lot of legal loopholes and has a very large national security concern. We want to address it completely. We want to solve the problem on DACA. And we want to solve the border security issue. We want to end chain migration. We want to end the visa lottery system. What we don't want to do is continue kicking the can down the road. We're focused on actually getting a solution. And frankly, I think if anybody's lazy, it's probably Democrats who aren't showing up to work and aren't actually getting to the table to make a deal on this.
Unreal. Unreal. The woman lies with such ease. It's no surprise she was brought up as Mike Huckabee's daughter. There's other breaking news, another staff shakeup, and this isn't one that we've been led to expect in recent days. White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter who I don't know where I got this from. It might have been Politico. They describe him as a mostly unknown but deeply influential aide who spends almost every day by President Trump's side, said today he plans to resign following abuse allegations from his two ex-wives. Now, this comes after the Daily Mail and The Intercept, by the way, published an interview with his second wife alleging abuse and pictures of black eyes and other bruises, with the White House standing firmly behind him. John Kelly, this is a quote from good old John Kelly, the White House chief of staff. Quote, Rob Porter is a man of true integrity and honor, and I can't say enough good things about him. The man who beat his two ex-wives, one of them allegedly over her weight. He would comment on her weight and punch her, according to this one ex-wife. Apparently, the resignation will not take effect immediately. The White House is standing by this miscreant. This is who we've got there. Unreal. And I also read somewhere that Hope Hicks is now dating this guy. Go figure. These people. This is who's in charge, people. This is who's in charge. All right. The story I mentioned at the top, Donald Trump has asked the Pentagon to explore holding a celebration for Americans to show their appreciation for the armed forces, the White House said, amid reports that military leaders have begun planning a military parade at his request. Trump repeatedly has expressed an interest in holding a display of America's military might and upped his calls for a parade after witnessing the Bastille Day celebrations on a trip to France last summer. This is Trump talking to President Macron about their Bastille Day parade.
I was your guest at Bastille Day, and it was one of the greatest parades I've ever seen. It was 2 hours on the button, and it was military might, and I think a tremendous thing for France and for the spirit of France. And to a large extent, because of what I witnessed, we may do something like that on July 4th in Washington, down Pennsylvania.
Now they're not talking about July 4th, but they are talking about maybe like Veterans Day. This would cause the tearing up of Pennsylvania Avenue and having to repave all those streets to allow the heavy tanks and artillery to go down the street. The whole thing would be a national nightmare. The Washington Post reported yesterday that at a recent meeting between Trump and top military officials, Trump's wishes were, quote, suddenly heard as a presidential directive. Still quoting, the marching orders were, I want a parade like the one in France. This is one military official telling the Post on the condition of anonymity. This is being worked at the highest levels of the military. Here's a CNN report.
A Pentagon spokesman a short time ago confirmed that they are looking at dates on the calendar for a parade that Mr. Trump apparently has told the Pentagon he wants as an expression of national unity and patriotism. Where does this whole idea come from with the president? Well, you'll recall over the summer, he was in Paris for Bastille Day, the French National Day, and he observed a very patriotic display by the French through portions of central Paris with their military force commemorating their National Day. And he was quite taken by it, saluting the French, all of that, saluting U.S. troops that participated at the time. And
this since is so
then,
embarrassing.
The idea, by all accounts, has intrigued him. So now the Pentagon looking at possible dates. But what are we really talking about here? There has not been a military parade typically by the U.S. military in many years. The last one really after a Desert Storm in the 1990s. If Mr. Trump wants a parade with tanks and missiles rolling through Pennsylvania Avenue down the route of the inauguration of the president, that may be a very complex issue that will be a little tougher than he anticipates. Those kinds of heavy weapons do damage to city streets. There are not that many U.S. troops stationed in the Capitol area. They are mainly such small ceremonial units, not, you know, military families, but not that many. If you are, who are currently serving overseas, it's going to be a difficult proposition, and it may be very controversial. The veterans have long wanted some kind of welcome home parade. This may be seen as something unduly militaristic overseas.
You think?
May be seen as an expression of celebrating years of America's wars abroad. I mean, these tanks are in the weight of tonnage, not necessarily something Washington, D.C. city streets may be able to tolerate. You're certainly going to have to remove all the street signs, all the light posts. It will be a very expensive proposition. What we more typically see is America's heroes marching down Broadway in New York.
Right. You know, someone in the chat room said, maybe how about a national holiday celebrating our veterans without the parade? Peter John 411 said, if you want to honor the military, take that money and put it into the VA. Now, there's an idea. Actually, take care of our soldiers who've returned home rather than make them march in a parade. There was I had a doctor's appointment this morning, and in the car, I was listening to CNN, and there was an interesting discussion on this military parade madness.
So after attending France's Bastille Day parade in Paris last summer, you heard the president say he wanted something similar in the U.S. Now, at the president's request, the Pentagon is looking into a grand military parade in Washington. So joining us now, CNN military analysts, Lieutenant General Mark Hertling and retired Rear Admiral and former Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. So, Admiral Kirby, what do you think of the idea of a military parade in Washington?
I don't like it, Allison, not at all. This is not about showcasing our military. This is about the president showing off. This is all about his ego. And that's just an inappropriate use of military time and talent and resources. The second thing is, this is beneath us as a nation. We are the most powerful military on earth. We're very proud of that, and rightly so. We don't need to be parading our military hardware down Pennsylvania Avenue to show that to anybody. And thirdly, I think it's just a waste of resources.
You
will cost millions of dollars. That's money that could be put to other better uses, operations, training, not to mention just taking care of our people, spouse education programs, that kind of thing. So I think this is just it's a tremendously bad idea.
So, General, you were, I think, in Iraq during the 1991 parade that they had to celebrate the, you know, unofficial end of the war back then. I guess that was President George H.W. Bush. So odd that they're having a parade while you're still out there fighting, but that's sometimes the nature of things. What do you make of this? Because the counterargument is, MAGA, baby, you know, let's show off our greatness. We love our military. Let's do what everybody else does.
Yeah, a couple of things, Chris. First of all, I was still in Iraq. We were still in combat, post-combat operations. And I'll never forget, you know, I was in an operations center, and one of our soldiers said, hey, they're having a parade back in the States with all the guys who fought over here except for us. And he said, I'd rather be here in combat than marching down Pennsylvania Avenue. So that kind of gives you the intent. I did an informal Twitter survey last night, very unscientific, but I will tell you it was about 100-0 in terms of people, soldiers, former military, saying they don't want any part of these kind of parades.
You think, you know, it's kind of ironic, too, as Trump didn't go to Vietnam due to bone spurs. You know about that, right? Stephen Colbert had a great cold open of his show last night.
At a speech with factory workers in Ohio, President Trump ripped into Democrats for not applauding him enough at the State of the Union speech.
They were like death. And un-American. Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not?
Senator Tammy Duckworth responded to President Trump with this tweet saying, I swore an oath in the military and in the Senate to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, not to mindlessly cater to the whims of cadet bone spurs.
G.I. Joe, G.I. Joe, fighting man who fought on the land, on the sea, in the air.
First, Hasbro brought you G.I. Joe. Then they brought you G.I. Joe with Kung Fu Grip. Now get ready for Hasbro's newest G.I. Joe character, Cadet Bonespurs.
Awesome!
He'd love to charge bravely into battle. It's just that he has this thing with his heel which causes occasional minor foot pain.
We must crush the enemy. Right, let's go get the bad guys. You go ahead. I have to ice my shin.
Cadet Bonespurs. It will be the greatest fun you've ever had playing soldier. Or in his case, avoiding playing soldier to date models.
The rebel forces are attacking. Help us, Cadet Bonespurs.
I would, but my socks are tight. You know, with the swelling and all.
So pick up your G.I. Joe Cadet Bone Spurs today. Now with Tiny Kung Fu Grip.
Ooh, yeah. Well, we know who's got those Cadet Bone Spurs. Anyway, all right. That's a bit of what's news for today. The live extended version for this Wednesday. I'm Nicole Sandler. Thank you for listening. Coming up, we're going to talk with our pal Gaius Publius. We're going to change the subject and talk about something equally frightening that the United States is equally remiss on. We're going to talk about climate change. Stick around.
These are the sounds of crushed souls, the sounds of despair from former radio personalities languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the internet, but their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to reestablishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio. And you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
All rise for Gaius Publius.
That's not his real name.
You call Gaius Publius into question?
Sure.
Very well. For the audience at home.
What is the real name of Gaius Publius?
Gaius Publius.
Oh, another winner!
Joins Nicole Sandler on NicoleSandler.com.
Our pal Gaius Publius writes regularly at a number of places, including downwithtyranny.com. You can get his newsletter at tinyletter.com/Gaius Publius and follow him on Twitter at Gaius_Publius. And he joins us now. Hello, Gaius.
How are you, Nicole?
Oh, you know, reeling from the news. It's just every day. It's just, I feel like I've been smacked upside the head, you know?
I recently saw a YouTube comedy video that mocked Groundhog Day, where somebody was waking up at 6 a.m. and they did the Groundhog Day shtick, and the news was, you know, all Trump, all Russia, all the time, and he ran out in the street and a friend of his said, "Are you protesting? We're all protesting today." Then it's the next day at 6 o'clock and the same thing happens, and he says, "Wait a minute, what day is this?" He says, "It's February 3rd. Oh God, this is worse.
Right.
It's not Groundhog Day. It's just every day is the same."
I saw the same video, and it is worse because every day it's more of the same. But, you know, the news about the Trump wanting this military parade, I mean, that gobsmacked me. And that's a word I don't use often.
Yeah, he's all show and not much go, apparently. But, you know, speaking of Trump, and I don't want to speak too much of Trump, but speaking of Trump, I want to recommend that people read Fire and Fury. There's in the first couple of chapters, there's a kind of a word portrait of who Trump is and how he acts that will add a lot of nuance to what the short one phrase characterization, like he's an idiot or he's a moron or this and that. There's a lot of nuance to that, which actually doesn't make it make sense, but it makes it easier to understand what you're watching. One thing that's not coming across that really ought to, he has the attention span of a bird.
Oh God. Well, he couldn't
get, which means he can't plan anything.
Right.
One more detail. Most people know he didn't write his book, The Art of the Deal.
Right.
A lot of people think he didn't even read it.
Probably not. I wouldn't doubt it. I don't think he reads.
No, he doesn't. I'm absolutely certain he doesn't.
Right. You know, I started reading Fire and Fury. I got about a third of the way through it. It's on the Kindle, so it tells me I'm 33% finished with it. And I put it down, and I just haven't been able to make myself pick it up again because I'm so inundated with Trump all the time. And it's like I can't escape him. And if I'm going to read something, do I really want to read about him? It's nauseating. It's actually literally nauseating.
Well, I'm reading it novelistically. It's actually entertainment for me. But at any rate, getting away from the one thing that's capturing all of our attentions into the one thing that should be capturing our attentions, right?
Should be, absolutely. Climate change. Before we get started, I ran across in preparing for our conversation today an interview that Scott Pruitt, who's the EPA administrator, did with a TV station in Nevada. I think it's News 3. And I'm just going to play for you. It's a short clip, but this underscores what our problem is. He was talking, it's self-explanatory. Here we go.
No one disputes the climate is changing. We see that that's constant. Mm-hmm. We obviously contribute to it. We live in the climate, right? So our activity contributes to the climate changing to a certain degree. Now, measuring that with precision, Gerard, I think is more challenging than is led on at times.
Yeah.
But I think the bigger question is what you ask at the very end. Is it an existential threat? Is it something that is unsustainable? Or what kind of effect or harm is this going to have? I mean, we know that humans have most flourished during times of what? Warming trends. So I think there's assumptions made that because the climate is warming, that necessarily is a bad thing. Do we really know what the ideal surface temperature should be in the year 2100, in the year 2018? And that's somewhat fairly arrogant for us to think that we know exactly what it should be in 2100. So there are very important questions around the climate issue that folks really don't get to. And that's one of the reasons that I've talked about having an honest, open, transparent debate about what do we know, what don't we know, so the American people can be informed. Yeah. And they can make decisions on their own with respect to these issues.
That's Scott Pruitt. Do we know what the optimum Earth temperature should be in 2100? That's arrogant of us to feel that way.
We know what the optimum Earth temperature is for us for the last 10,000 years. We also know that as the temperature warms, as the Earth's surface temperature warms, which is not the only way global warming happens, by the way, it also warms the oceans.
Right.
But as the Earth's surface temperature warms, we can predict, it has been done scientifically, how many days over 100 degrees each part of the world will experience. And days over 100 degrees affect crops. They also affect the ability to actually walk outside without air conditioning, without an air conditioning unit surrounding you, otherwise known as a space suit.
Mm-hmm.
So those things are known. You know, Scott Pruitt is just propagandizing there. But he's young enough that those of us, I'm not one of them, who are revenge-minded could hope that he perhaps lives until into his 80s and perhaps some people who are angry at him find him and keep him aware of his sins for a long time.
You know, you talk about him being in his 80s, and it's interesting you bring that up, because one thing, when I think about the climate and what's happening on our planet or to our planet, I hear about somebody getting pregnant or having a baby, I worry. I really worry about that new life and what this planet's going to be like when that child is 20 years old. I said that to someone just earlier today, and she said, or when they're 80. I can't even imagine.
The piece that we started when we talked about having this segment, we initially talked about a piece where Cape Town, South Africa is running out of water.
Yes, your latest and piece at downwithtyranny.com.
Thank you. And I've since followed this story up a little bit more carefully. I may write a follow-up of it shortly. But it's in the National Geographic, which, by the way, has been bought by Fox Corp. Or
yes,
News
Corp.
Fox,
right.
Whatever.
News Corp, right.
Right. They're saying that, they're quoting people saying that in essence, this thing is accelerating and nobody knows how fast it's accelerating and it's frightening people. I think you're talking about in your 20s. I think it's going to be sooner than that a real panic starts globally. And notice that the social effects, the political effects, and the military effects will precede the actual climate effects, the worst of them, because we as a species, one of our great virtues is we can anticipate.
Sure.
And once a critical mass of people start to anticipate what's going on, we're going to see the kind of chaos that's going to make it more and more difficult to coordinate a good response. So you have a child, you don't have grandchildren. I have two grandchildren are both in diapers, as a matter of fact.
Oh,
God help their parents. But those two young kids are going to, by the time they're in their 40s and 50s, they're going to see a great bulk of the world be hunter-gatherers. And I swear to God, there's going to be a die-off at some point if we don't get a grip on this. And I'm not saying that's inevitable, but we do need to get a grip on it now. And I'm encouraged by the fact, by the way, that Scott Pruitt, someone like him, even though he doesn't believe in man-made global warming, he recognizes that even his audience, his market, believes in man-made global warming. Mm. So his spin has changed. I think that's a recognition that there is a growing private understanding among even Republicans that this could be a problem that needs addressing.
Well, let's talk about this piece you wrote. It's up at downwithtyranny.com. I'll put a link to it from my blog where I post the day's show, the podcast, at NicoleSandler.com. You wrote, in April 2018, Cape Town, South Africa could become the first major city to run entirely out of water. Cape Town, South Africa. This is going to be you. What does that look like? You go to turn on the spigot and nothing comes out?
Correct. Nothing comes out because the city planners, the city fathers and mothers, have decided that they can't. Let me see if I can find the quote for you. I did a follow-up story I'm reading a follow-up at National Geographic, and there actually is a plan that they have. And I can't find it exactly. What they're going to do is here we go. If consumption doesn't drop steeply and quickly, I'm quoting National Geographic now. City officials warned earlier this week, everyone will be forced into day zero. That's that April day that my piece talked about, which they think can be moved into May.
Wow.
Where all will have to live on far less, about 25 liters of water a day, less than typically used in 4 minutes of showering. So what do they do to ration water? They certainly are going to ration water severely. 25 liters of water isn't very much. You get enough to drink. People aren't going to die of thirst. But economic activity is going to stop, and the kind of lifestyle changes are going to be drastic. I noted in the piece, by the way, that about 10% of the money that is generated by the city of Cape Town, South Africa, is generated by tourism.
Right.
That tourism is going to forgive the metaphor dry up rather quickly.
It has to. Yeah, you point out what they're going to tell tourists, what when you take a shower, keep a bucket for the runoff and then use that to flush the toilet. I can't see going on a vacation and having to do that in your bathroom.
Well, this goes back to the old hippie motto that was a water-saving motto, by the way, back in the 60s and 70s. If it's yellow, let it mellow.
Right.
If it's brown, flush it down. that was quoted in that article at AccuWeather. I didn't quote it for my piece, but the AccuWeather piece quoted a travel blogger in South Africa saying, this is what the Chamber of Commerce is asking people to do.
Well, I mean, and obviously tourism will be the casualty because people will just go somewhere else. But I wonder about the people who are living there, who have homes. Did they just get up and leave? Is this something that insurance covers? Or is it, you know, considered an act of God where you're just out of luck and you leave, but yet your mortgage follows you?
Well, and you're asking the right question. And let me ask of you who live in Florida,
right,
who will see this kind of thing later than Cape Town did, but still it's the same problem. Let's hypothesize there's a massive typhoon, Haiyan type hurricane,
yep,
the one that swept through a couple of years ago, the Philippines, and devastated it. Let's say that sweeps through South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody dies because we don't want people to die, but property values are absolutely destroyed. And there's a wake-up call where all of a sudden people don't develop South Beach anymore. They don't have those grand developments in Miami.
Right.
And property values start to fall. everybody's property value starts to fall. Do you have insurance for that? Do anybody you know have insurance for an economic collapse that's caused by climate change where your property value goes to zero?
I don't think so. I can't imagine
anybody
exists.
Buys that.
Right.
I mean, to get an earthquake rider on your property, you have to actually get an earthquake rider. It's not
right.
covered.
Right. And in that's in California. I remember paying for that. In Florida, you have to have a wind policy and a flood policy. They're two separate things, and they'll try to get you if your house is damaged in a hurricane. You know, they'll try to say, well, this is wind damage, not water damage, or the other way around, so as not to pay you off. Mm-hmm. You know, but just because of an act of nature, I don't think that's covered. There's some stupid commercial for a home warranty deal. And they say you're covered. Your homeowner's insurance covers zombie apocalypse, but it doesn't cover your refrigerator going out. Yeah, I don't think we're covered for zombie apocalypse
either. And the damage that these people are talking about are actual physical damage. They're not talking about economic damage to homes that aren't physically damaged yet, but that can't be insured and can't be resold
right.
at anything close to their value.
Look at Puerto Rico. I mean, this is a prime example. Puerto Rico was devastated, and we have a government that won't acknowledge it. That I think the story about FEMA leaving was walked back. But still, we have still at least 30% of the island is still without power. We've got, you know, houses that are just a couple of walls standing. Those places, those people are not going to have, they're not going to be made whole by any sense of the word.
No, and if you want to game that further, it's easy to think of, I use this term clinically, it sounds so polemical, but it really is a clinical term. If there was somebody in your town who wanted only money and nothing else and was willing to kill people for it, you would call that person crazy. You would call them a sociopath.
Right.
Our economic institutions at the level of the biggest corporations act sociopathically. They control government to make sure that people die as long as their profit is protected. That's sociopathic behavior. So there are humans behind this. It's not just an institution. Corporations don't do anything that their directors and CEO class doesn't direct them to do.
Right.
So let's say you've got this economic collapse that we're talking about, which will occur at some point if we don't get a hold of this thing. In that economic collapse, you're going to have people clamoring to be made whole. That can't happen from insurance, so they're going to go to government, and the government is going to tell them what? Do you think they're going to say yes or no to that?
Is that a rhetorical question?
I'm giving you Donald, it's a slow pitch across
right,
the plate.
Right. Donald Trump's America is going to say, no, we've got to put on a military parade.
I think even neoliberals will say, we'll try to do as much as we can, but in classic, we can't afford it, how are you going to pay for it fashion, they will say we have to limit this. At some point, the money for these things is going to dry up, and people who control government, that's our sociopaths, are going to have to decide how to address it and who's ox gets gored and whose ox gets saved. Can't you imagine that there's going to be this monster scramble to save the rich people's ox at the expense of everybody else's?
Of course. Although,
don't you see that as a precursor to a kind of civil war?
I think we're getting closer and closer. Although, you know, we saw with the fires in California not too long ago, the fire didn't care if the house was a cheap shack or a zillion-dollar mansion. It knew no class division there. The fire took whoever it was going to take. By the same token, you know, California, and you know it better, you're on the West Coast. I know you don't live in California, but California is still suffering from a drought, even though it had a slight respite with, I guess, an El Nino or a La Nina, whichever one brings water. Got a little bit of a break that then brought the floods. California is still having drought problems. I mean, we're talking about Cape Town, South Africa drying up and having no water, but this could happen in California. I'm looking at an article in the LA Times. I think it's in today's paper. Devin Nunes is in the news. So the headline reads, "The Nunes memo made this congressman a national name, but his California district cares about water, not Russia." And his district is hurt by the drought. They're going dry in the San Joaquin Valley.
Yes. Thank you for that pivot, because I can't help but make that pivot. I did it in the article as well. Mm-hmm. The cities like Cape Town, by the way, there were cities in India. Jakarta is in this problem. Wow. Mexico City's approaching this problem, but not American cities. But cities like that are the canary in the coal mine with respect to that. At some point, back before the El Nino hit, I was writing about the California drought and looking at the political conflict between the farmers and the city dwellers. The farmers have the oldest and most legally defensible claim, first right to water. Most of those farmers got their land in the transition from Mexican ownership to U.S. ownership in the 1800s, and they can place their right of title back to the old Mexican rancheros. So they have first right to water, but the city dwellers greatly outnumber them. This is San Diego, Los Angeles, and so forth. So and the farmers typically are people who waste water for profit. Obviously, they serve a benefit, to the United States. But they're not growing the kinds of things they're not focusing primarily on the kinds of things that the United States needs. It's not like our breadbasket. They're growing pistachios, for example, and almonds, most of which are exported. So they're just growing things for profit. And in fact, most of the farms these days, not most, but many of them, are owned and are being bought by hedge funds who see them as investments, the way they buy hotel chains and restaurant chains and so forth. There's going to be a coming huge political conflict in California between who gets the water. Are you going to save a semi-arid desert like Los Angeles? I mean, should people actually be living in Los Angeles, right, if you come down to it? Should they be living in Phoenix? Or are you going to save the people who have the money to put politicians in office? And again, this is going to look like a civil war. And the whole American Southwest, Arizona and California at the tip of the spear are going to be experiencing this.
Right. The way we're speaking with Gaius Publius, by the way, who's got a few articles on this subject, on climate change, up at Down With Tyranny. I'll link to a number of them on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com. Do we have any kind of time frame? I mean, I know things are getting warmer. You've got one particularly sort of in the weeds article just from a week or so ago, 2017 breaks climate records despite no El Nino boost. That is very technical, but it seems like the temperatures are rising faster than anyone ever predicted they would.
We could very well be on the verge of an acceleration.
Oh, God.
Nobody promised anybody that this would be linear.
Nope.
Though both political parties who are beholden to oil and gas money have allowed us to think that we've got until 2050 to ramp things down, that we can do a kind of a soft landing for the oil and gas companies, which means you kick the can to the next generation and they get to give them the bad news that you have to go out of business, because the current generation of politicians aren't going to do it. It's predicated on the assumption that we know what the ramp is going to look like, the slope of the ramp, ramp up to disaster or ramp down to zero for oil and gas emissions. But the fact is, oil and gas emissions appear to be accelerating.
Mm-hmm.
The CO2 in the air, I did a piece a couple of years ago about how that looks like we're going up faster in our intrusion of carbon dioxide into the air. And just recently, it's starting to look like we're getting the surface warming effect of that at an accelerating pace also. What's remarkable is that The last El Nino years, 97 and 98, saw a big leap up in global warming. And then for the next couple of years, things were relatively flat, even though the long-term trend was up. People were calling this the pause, and the right-wingers were saying there's no more global warming anymore. It stopped. Well, then we had the El Nino of 2015-2016, which did a ramp up. And we're expecting a pause after that as things settle down. 2017 outdid 2015 and came just below 2016 as the second warmest year in the instrumental record period. In other words, we didn't get that pause we should get in a non-El Nino year. It's jumping. And if this is a trend, we could be looking at a problem that won't be solved before Trump is out of office, that needs to be solved before Trump is out of office.
Right.
And I'm talking 4 years, not 8 years.
Oh, my God. I mean, just all we have to do is look at this last, I put it in terms of hurricane season because I live in Florida. But between the onslaught of hurricanes we had, we got hit with a 1-2-3 punch of massive storms, each bigger than the one before. Then the fires and the drought, then the floods. And it's just like, I don't think we can survive that. If that happens another year, already look at Puerto Rico, who didn't get the money they need. I don't know what it's like in Houston, but Houston was devastated. We don't hear much about them anymore, I guess, unless you're in Houston, but I know they're not recovered from that. And yet it could happen just as easily again, and it could be even worse.
Yeah. And against that, on the positive side, is this backlog of people actually getting it. Even Republicans, they get it. And I think it's a secret understanding. I'm not talking about Republican politicians because they're just propagandists.
Right.
But I'm talking about Republican voters. I think even in the Deep South, they get it. They know. That's why, as I said, that's why Scott Pruitt is spinning this the way he is, and let's delay instead of deny. And that understanding, if something shakes people's consciousness in a way that's stepwise, in a way that's not incremental and gradual, but all of a sudden there's like a wake-up call. I don't want to wish for anybody to die, but something dramatic enough where people say, okay, that's it, I've had it, do something, in time to actually get stuff done. Because the damage from climate change isn't all or nothing. We can mitigate a lot of it if we start today. We can mitigate an awful lot of it.
Can we? That was going to be my next question. I mean, look, I have no hope, as long as Trump is in office, for sure, of the United States doing anything. We're the only nation on the planet that pulled out of the Paris Accord, the Paris Climate Accord. I forget the other two that were out, and I'm drawing a blank on which ones they were. Both went in, one because it wasn't strong enough, and another that we were the outliers. Well, now we're the only ones who are not in this thing. But is the rest of the planet, are they doing anything to mitigate this?
Oh, yeah. And the good news is, this is actually, Trump pulling out is good news, because I hate to say it to those in the audience who identify as a Democrat, but the Democrats were going to offer pretend solutions.
Right.
And frankly, let's have, if we're going to have a pretend solution, let's have a guy in office who's going to offer no solution. So people will get serious of not pretending that the government is their ally and start to do it themselves. And that's what the world is starting to do. They're starting to do it. The U.S. is a useless ally in this.
Yes.
And they're starting to act without the U.S. And frankly, environmental groups in the United States, without the kind of, well, we have to pretend that Obama's this wonderful person because we're allies with the Democratic Party, who are doing this half measure, and yeah, we got to cheer them on. With those shackles off of our wrists and ankles, maybe we can get some even stronger action from the people who count, which is us.
Well, that would be nice. Yeah, as you note in one of the articles that I'll link to, there's a small handful of candidates in 2018 who would even say that they will not take money from the fossil fuel industry.
Yes, and a lot, and even those, you're talking about Democrats here.
Yes.
I'll tell you, this ties to the economic story. I don't think Democrats are battling to see if they can fail to win in 2018. They're really struggling to see if they can fail against a wave that ought to march them into great power.
Mm-hmm.
If they fail, it's going to be an interesting outcome. I'm just going to hold that there.
Yeah.
If Democrats fail, if Joe Kennedy, who wouldn't mention climate change in his response to Trump, for example,
mm-hmm.
if the Democrats fail to look like they're providing a solution, it's going to be a little bit like Trump failing to provide a solution. Will that activate people or depress people? It's an interesting thought.
I don't know
that Democrats will fail. Howie Klein, whom you have on
he'll be on tomorrow, as frequently, is
very optimistic, though nervous.
Okay, good, because I could use some optimism about now. There's not a lot of it coursing through my veins these days. Oh, guys, Publius, we're out of time. It's on a depressing subject. Time flew by. Thank you so much for caring, for writing these articles, because it's stuff that we need to be aware of, we need to think about, because it's part of our reality now. Find Gaius Publius on Twitter at Gaius_Publius. I'll put up a link on my blog at NicoleSandler.com and, of course, to those articles at DownWithTyranny.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole.
And you. Take care. Bye-bye.